Welcome to A Dopamine Kick.
Yes, another ADHD podcast.
We're your hosts, Sparky and Shell.
Join us each week and we can hyper-focus together on all things ADHD.
This is our journey to diagnosis, the challenges, frustrations and humour that come when living with ADHD as adults.
Let the interrupting begin!
Hello everyone, welcome to episode 88 of A Dopamine Kick. Today we are super excited because we have a really special guest with us today. We've got James Brown from the ADHD Adults Podcast.
Yay! Woo!
Hi guys, how are you? Can I first start off by apologising because obviously we've been trying to get this sorted, I reckon, for a year. And
must be about that, yeah.
As I am literally the most unreliable person on the planet, it's been put off and mistakenly, you know, scheduled and then cancelled at the last minute. So I think a year is a pretty good, chapeau to you. Well done. You've managed to pin me down to just a year to actually get me on the podcast. But I'm really excited to be here.
James is a professor. He's not a real doctor, though, are you, James?
I'm not even a real professor. Mate, I'm not even a real professor. I'm a visiting professor. That's
Ooh,
a little bit
a visiting
like
professor.
Well, it's like, you know, it's like a clown doctor is to a real doctor, in that you're not a real professor and you can't use the title for life, but for 3 years you can use the title professor. But if you ever use it in front of another academic, they'll stab your eyes out and piss in the holes because you haven't earned that title you've been given. So when I left university under a bit of a cloud, luckily one of my ex-bosses quite liked me and he wanted me to stay doing kind of media engagement stuff, so they gave me the title of visiting professor, which Alex loves because it's not a real professor. So it's a double whammy there, Sparky. I'm not a real doctor and nor am I a real professor.
Well, do you know what, I'm also not a real doctor and Sparky loves to lord that over me, so I am excited to have a bit of company tonight.
Good. It's about time I had someone else with me that understands the pain.
The pain, yeah.
Not being a real doctor.
You also do talks around the UK as a public speaker as well. So I know whether you want to admit it or not, you do know your stuff on all things ADHD and Science Behind It All. So welcome to the podcast. We are so excited to have you on here. Finally.
We went to one of your talks, actually. We went to the Birmingham one.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
Ages ago.
Yeah, shit venue. I shouldn't say that because some of them might be listening. But yeah, a great crowd because it's Birmingham. And yeah. It's weird doing the talks because I haven't been a lecturer for 20 years. There's people that have kind of said, the superpower strength thing of ADHD. You know, some of the happy clappers have said, oh, you know, is that your strength? It's like, no, I spent 20 years teaching uninterested students and having to come up with ways to keep their interest for 5 minutes. So actually standing in front of a crowd of people that actually want to hear what you've got to say is a piece of piss. As long as you know vaguely what you're talking about, it's such a rewarding thing. It's probably kind of the favorite thing that I do, even more than the podcast, because Alex isn't there most of the time.
Oh, Alex was there for that one. So you've
I can't. This is the problem. He manages to slimy segue his way into some of these... into some of these talks, but never gets his name on the slide, which he hates, and I love that.
You're so mean to each other. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's only like how you're mean to me as well, Shell. She's constantly...
I'm not mean to you. I'm realistic to you.
It's a good reframing, isn't it? But the thing is, if it's authentic and it comes from a place of love, when I first met Alex, I thought... I'd moved from Wolverhampton University, not a great renowned university. It was in the bottom 10 of universities.
Is that where
at the
you
time.
Went, Sparky?
Shut up. I actually Do you know what? I went to Wolverhampton, but I knew it was in the bottom. I didn't want to go for the work, I told you.
Listen, I will take nothing away from it because it got me where I went. And at the end of the day, it has a remit, a widening participation remit. When I first applied to go there, their admissions policy was very strict. It was, yeah, turn up Monday, which is what I did to start.
Yeah,
it is.
But
if they hadn't had that widening participation remit, I wouldn't have got a degree. But going from Wolverhampton to Warwick, which was like seventh in the table, and having all this imposter syndrome of clearly someone at some point is going to put their hand on my shoulder and say, sorry, what are you doing here? But at the interview, you know, everyone was dressed in suits because it's quite a posh kind of business-based university, apart from this scruffy guy wearing jeans and a shit jumper. Alex always wears shit jumpers. He has the worst taste in clothes of any person under the age of 150 that I know. And I kind of looked at him and he came out and said, are you ready to come in for the interview? And I thought, why have they hired a tramp to ask me to come in to the interview? And then when he was on the panel, I thought, okay, hang on, is this some kind of, again, you know, public engagement, take somebody that's disadvantaged and get them involved in an academic interview? And it turned out he was a lecturer there, and I was stunned. And I didn't speak to him for about the first 2 months because I didn't speak to anyone because I was obviously very scared of people finding out that I'm pig shit thick. And then after about 3 months, we kind of bonded. And from then, what you hear on the podcast was exactly what we were immediately like. After that 3 month period of not speaking to each other, we immediately slipped into just realizing we had the same sense of humor and giving each other kind of just from a point of love, kind of abuse all the time. And we're even now outside of the podcast, when we're in our darkest places, like when my dad was very ill and when Alex is really struggling, you know, the response you'll get, Alex shared this on Twitter, actually. He sent me the message one day saying, I'm really struggling. You know, I'm in a really dark place. I'm having, I'm struggling to get out of bed and to do anything. I feel like a failure. And I said, listen, mate, you need to listen to this. It's really important. Just remember, you're a massive twat and everybody hates you. And he, but that's how we deal with each other. So, and when I'm in a really dark place, he'll say the same thing, but it brightens me up when I'm in a dark place to have humor, because humor is such a central part of my life. Mm. And I think for a lot of people with ADHD, it is. And I think we have to sometimes use humor to de-weaponize ADHD a bit and to sometimes learn to laugh at some of the things that we do, you know, that can otherwise, you know, lead us to frustration and tears. So I'm lucky in that we've always said for the podcast, just be ourselves, you know, just be authentic. And if, as long as we're doing that, we never plan for anyone to listen. I mean, Jesus Christ, who listened to us? And then it just started to get listeners. And we had two rules at the start, and that was be authentic. And another one I've forgotten.
I think we sort of had similar vibes, didn't we, when we started ours? We decided very early on that we couldn't be anything other than authentic, because we would just forget which persona we were trying to play.
And so then we'd be found out anyway. So it wouldn't have lasted very long if we tried.
It's a weird thing though, isn't it, starting a podcast, because you're putting yourself out there in the world. You're creating something, and then you're casting it out there for people to like, dislike, to not listen to listen to. And I think what helped us was we genuinely didn't care if anybody ever listened. We just enjoyed having fun. And it all came from, I don't know if I told you this, Shell, when you visited, it all came from the Twitter Chocolate Bar World Cup.
You definitely haven't told me this.
Yeah. So during the second lockdown, when everybody's mental health was in the bin, for a laugh, I said on Twitter, and I used to be on Twitter, and Alex used to say I was a blue tick wanker because I did have a blue tick, and he never got one. Ha ha. But I said for a laugh one day, why don't we do a chocolate bar World Cup? And lots of people were like, yeah, okay. And I obviously rigged it because I just wanted to annoy people. So I kept out some of the, so 16 chocolate bars, keeping out some of the good ones, pitched them against each other, and we'd have a daily vote. And Alex and I would do a daily debate where we would film each other doing a short, and we would just say, which one are you going to pick? Oh, you're going to pick crunchy, I'll do dairy milk then. So we didn't care about it, but we would just go at each other, like insulting each other and having fun in this debate, and people started to like it. And this was kind of the kernel of it turning, like, much later on into a podcast, because people would say to us, oh, you're going to do more debates, you know, that was, it's kind of funny. And that dynamic which we'd always had in person, it's the first time we'd really shared it, and that was very much kind of the basis for how we then formed the podcast.
That's a really nice story. I'm going to look up those. Are they still available?
Yeah, they'll still be on Twitter. The videos will still be there. And we did a biscuit World Cup after that, which, of course, Chocolate Hobnobs won, because what else would? It's obvious. And Dairy Milk won the Chocolate Bar World Cup, just in case you're interested, which angered quite a lot of people. But
I wouldn't have said that.
Yeah, but, you know, when I'm in charge of the vote, it's not going to be fair, is it?
Was there a vote, or did you always know?
Well, when you've got multiple Twitter accounts and people that you can direct message and say, make sure you vote for Dairy Milk, it does help you get the, does help you get the result you wanted.
So you're from Birmingham. How have you got a better accent than me?
Right. Well, this is the
thing. I don't have a particularly Brummy accent.
So I'm from Kidderminster. Now, Kidderminster has a worse accent than Birmingham. If you imagine somebody from Birmingham with dog shit in their mouth talking, that's what the Kidderminster accent is.
Yeah, because Kidderminster is black country, right?
Well, it's not. It's actually Worcestershire. But the accent is like a mixture of Brummy, black country, and dog shit.
If you imagine
somebody spewing out this awful guttural half countryside, half Birmingham accent, that's Kidderminster. Now, when I went, there is an ADHD link to this. Believe it or not. When I first went to Wolverhampton as a PhD student, so I'd done my degree, I'd finished it. I'd gone like, as many of us do, what am I going to do? I'll do teacher training. Went up to Liverpool. Fucking hated that. And because I was the biggest person on the course, they sent me to the roughest school in Toxteth to learn how to teach. I wasn't particularly pleased with that. And luckily, a couple of weeks into that experience, somebody emailed me saying, do you want to do a PhD? Because somebody's just left. Didn't even interview, because again, Wolverhampton. So I went down. And two things happened. One, I wasn't called James. I was called Jim Bob or Bob by everybody. That's what everyone called me, apart from mum and dad if I was in trouble. But the first person that called me James, I thought, that sounds cleverer. So I just said yes. So full on imposter syndrome, low self-esteem, kind of people pleasing. I'm not going to correct you. I'll just be called James from now on. And also, I tried to lose the accent because, again, it's really difficult to take anybody seriously when they're talking about molecular biology when they've got a Kidderminster accent. Mm. So it's masking. I've learned to mask my accent and my name even to try and come across as somebody who isn't pig shit there.
Oh, so you just fake then?
Yeah, complete, that's a complete, absolutely, 100%.
Right. Let's try something relevant. Shake it up a little bit. Tell us about your ADHD medication journey. So the first one you were on, how did it go?
We started doing kind of monetized membership stuff, and one of the first things we did was look back at the episodes we'd done, and the second episode we did on the podcast was on medication, and we talked about this at the time. Because of my hyper-focusing on medical issues, on pharmacology, on medicine in general, I've never gone into a GP's office or a consultant's office without knowing what I want and without knowing what to say to get it. Now, because I also have a binge eating disorder, I did not want to be given methylphenidate. I wanted to be given lisdexamfetamine or Elvance. Mm-hmm. So in my assessment, I said, can I please have lisdexamfetamine? Because I think I know it's more effective in adults, and I also have a binge eating disorder. And the psychiatrist said, yes, so that's the only medication I've been on. I started off, as most people do, 20 milligrams. It's weird. You hear the different kind of increments that different titrators will give people. Started off on 20, nothing. Raised to 30, nothing. 40, started to feel a bit more motivation, really. And I now realize actually that's what the tablets do, because motivation is based on reward. And if you get reward, which is from dopamine, you'll be motivated to do stuff. But it still didn't feel kind of, I was expecting this magical bullet. And in the end, I ended up on the highest dose of 70, fully kind of committed and accepting to the fact that it had done absolutely nothing for me. And said in my kind of discharge appointment, when he said, how'd you find the meds? I said, well, it's done nothing. I'm no different. And my psychiatrist said, well, every single score on the ASRS has moved to the left. So literally everything is improved. But that's an ADHD thing. We often have poorer metacognition, which is why that test that we do, the ASRS, can be untrustworthy, because fill it in on a Monday and you'll think, do I do that often or very often? Very often. Fill it in on Thursday.
Every time. Yeah.
Exactly. And therefore, relying on a single snapshot of a day when you're asked, how often do I you know, make careless mistakes and lack attention to detail? Well, clearly with me, it is very often. But for some of them, and we in a recent episode, I remember saying, oh, great, yeah, we went through the last three of the nine diagnostic ones for inattention, actually, and these are really big for me. And then when we looked at them, I went, oh, actually, yeah, number eight, I don't do that. And then went, oh, yeah, no, I do. And it's weird because we can almost forget, you know, our behaviours and our abilities, and often have what's called a positive illusory bias, which means that we can overestimate our abilities in some areas to the point where we think we have even done stuff we haven't done. So the meds had worked. I just wasn't aware of it. I've been on them ever since. I'll be honest, and this, I don't know if it worries me or not, if I don't take them for a day, I don't notice a difference. Now, a lot of people will say, oh God, you know, if I don't take them for a day, then immediately I remember what it was like before. If I don't take them, I honestly don't think I'm any different. So I don't know whether or not they've lost a bit of effectiveness. I don't know whether or not they've altered my brain chemistry enough that a day off doesn't really matter. But that is, it's something I do think about a lot, that if I don't often forget to take them, but sometimes I will deliberately not take them. And I genuinely don't feel like, oh God, I can't organize and I'm more ditzy or forgetful. I don't feel any different.
So would you try longer off them?
Yeah, and I've thought about this. This is the thing. There's no evidence behind medication holidays, but if you look at the long-term adherence to medication, so after 5 years, I don't know if you know this statistic, after 5 years, what percentage of adults with ADHD do you think are still taking their medication?
I know it's low, but I can't remember the number. I'll guess at 30%.
Sparky?
15?
12.5% of patients. So that means 87.5% of patients.
Quick maths.
not so good at the maths. 87.5% of patients have stopped taking their meds. Now, we don't know why, because these studies haven't really looked. Is it because the side effects? Is it because they stop being effective? Or is it because, and there is some emerging evidence, that particularly the stimulants, they don't just mitigate the symptoms, they actually cause nerves to grow, or neurites, which are the little kind of fingery projections from nerves, they grow a bit more. And that can increase the connectivity between the areas of the brain that don't talk to each other well in ADHD. So it's possible that people stop taking them because they stop working, because they just forget one day and then don't re-engage with it, or because if they do stop taking them and they can cope better, it's because their brain has changed slightly. And the problem is with medication holidays, I think they are probably a good idea from a theoretical perspective, because if any chemical in the body, whether it's a hormone or a neurotransmitter, if you keep on having lots of it, the receptors for it, which are like the lock, which the key slides into to open one neuron that's talking to another neuron, they hide those receptors because of what's called resistance. So there's a chance that actually by constantly taking something that causes a dopamine release, those dopamine receptors might hide away a bit. And theoretically, therefore, if you take a break, there's a chance those receptors will come back. But nobody's really looked at it. It's a big gaping hole ding that isn't being sufficiently looked at in terms of research.
So what can you tell us about the long-term safety effects of stimulants? Would you say that they're safe to take long-term? Because me and Shell are like, when any time we've got to take medication, we end up freaking out.
Yeah, and I get that. I think there's a couple of levels to this. First of all, there are lots of people that are medication hesitant because they don't trust pharmaceutical companies. And, you know, that is sometimes warranted. Pharmaceutical companies have in the past hidden data, fabricated data, released drugs that they know will kill people. But that's often, you know, that's not the general practice. It just happens occasionally because it costs $1.2 billion to develop a new drug. And if you've just spaffed all that money up the wall and you know that a few people might die, as a psychopathic, you know, pharmaceutical company CEO, you're going to do that math and say, yeah, we'll release that drug. And it's only when more people die than you expect that you would draw it back. Most pharmaceutical drugs are rigorously tested.
I'm just looking at Shell's face. You know, one of those like film shots that zooms in the background, like what's it called? A dolly shot. Terrified.
But this is the vast minority. Now, what's interesting to me is that many of the people that are medication hesitant when it comes to pharmaceutical drugs will take supplements, will take all types of supplements because, you know, they see them as being safe. Now, these are completely untested, completely unregulated. You have no idea if they even contain the ingredient they claim to contain. Many of these supplements that have been imported from China have been shown to contain heavy metals such as lead. And a chemical is a chemical is a chemical. So if you take a supplement, it's still doing the same thing if it works as a pharmaceutical chemical, only it hasn't been tested for safety. And it's really important. I don't know if you two have ever taken a medication where it said on the packet, don't have grapefruit juice with this.
Yeah.
Now the reason for this is that the liver, which is what detoxifies the body, it breaks down compounds into metabolites so that they can be excreted in the urine and in the feces and in sweat. And it has a series of enzymes to do that. But those enzymes, sometimes the same enzyme will break down 10 different compounds. So if you take two different compounds, say one that's pharmaceutical and one that's a supplement, and it's the same enzyme that breaks them both down, it can only do one of them at once. So often when people take supplements or even microdose, for example, at the same time as taking a medication, you never know what interaction you're going to get in terms of the metabolism. So that's this kind of first level. Then the second level, and I agree with this, Shell, is that psychiatric medications are fucking abhorrent in the most part. They are incredibly blunt tools which are used with remarkably little evidence base. If you look at antidepressants, you know, the boom in the 90s based on Prozac and selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And now when you look at the evidence, you know, it is more effective to go for a 30-minute walk a day in a green area than it is to take an SSRI in terms of depression. And yet the side effects that they can have can be really profound. And this is what I find fascinating with ADHD meds. If we all remember that wonderful Panorama program where they used the phrase, powerful drugs are being handed out without checks. I'm sorry, but the effect that citalopram and sertraline and mirtazapine and all these, the effect they've have on me and pregabalin is 100 times worse and more powerful than lisdexamfetamine. And yet they're handed out by GPs like willy-nilly. Oh, you come with depression here, take this. Or, you know, you've got chronic pain, have this, you know, pregabalin or really, really damaging drugs. But for me, the impact, you know, if you look at the long-term risk, and this is really good timing to ask that question, Sparky, because lots of people will talk about, well, they're cardiovascular stimulants, you know, there's going to be an increased risk of cardiovascular events such as heart attacks or high blood pressure, a massive meta-analysis, which is where a group of scientists take all the studies that have been done, gather the data into one big data set, so that it's like, instead of 10 studies looking at 1,000 people, it's looking at 10,000 people. And a massive big meta-analysis looked at it and said there is no increased risk of cardiovascular risk of taking stimulants if you have ADHD. And what that shows us is that whilst no drug is ever safe for everybody, there will always be some people that will have adverse reactions. For the majority of people, they are safe and effective drugs.
But well, that's good to know after your terrifying start to that.
No, but I definitely agree with the antidepressant thing, because I was saying to Shell not long ago, like, I'm really concerned because I feel every single time I've taken an antidepressant, I get more side effects than positives. But it's interesting to hear that, like you said, on that program that they said it's powerful drugs, and yet to get at least lisdexamfetamine and ADHD medication, you have to go through like a vigorous process to get that, but you can just go to a GP and they can hand it that out to anybody.
Yeah. You can be prescribed them over the phone. You don't even have to see a GP in person.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. And again, it comes down to, I suppose, how you would semantically describe the word powerful, because I think what they really should have said, these are controlled drugs. These are drugs that have a level of, because of their abusability, that's why they are controlled. They're no more, you know, taking 70 milligrams of speed is not powerful. Believe me, I took a lot of speed in the 90s, and 70 milligrams wouldn't have lasted me, you know, half a night in a club. Now, and that, you know, okay, that wouldn't have quite been the same purity, but it, yes, clearly stimulants have an effect on people, but as you may be, for most people with ADHD, it's actually a calming effect. you know, and therefore I get that you wouldn't want to throw them about willy-nilly, but then why do we with compounds like pregabalin, gabapentin, you know, Prozac and other compounds that can have a massive impact in terms of side effects on your cognitive function, on your mood, on your libido, on your weight, on, you know, headaches, on all muscle pains, all sides, all types of side effects rather.
Yeah, we did a whole episode on mirtazapine, didn't we? Because you got prescribed mirtazapine and you only managed to take it for what, 2 days?
So Mrs. ADHD did, when before we knew she had ADHD and we thought she had depression, and she'd been on a couple of antidepressants and she wasn't sleeping. Now mirtazapine, as you may remember from your experience, it makes you do two things, sleep and eat, basically. Yeah. And when you're not sleeping, you're eating, and when you're not eating, you're sleeping.
That's so true.
I can remember watching Mrs. ADHD kind of like a starving macaque, which has just found a bag of Bombay mix, clawing at food. And while one hand was filling her mouth, she's looking at the next handful and almost like lining up what the next handful of food is. And we used to have a fun cupboard because as a binge eater, I liked to have stuff I could binge eat. She cleared that cupboard in one go and was then looking for more, and then would fall asleep for 21 hours. So she'd be awake for 3 hours eating, and then sleep for 21 hours. So exactly the same, 2 days, two doses. And then we agreed, this isn't a life.
Really. Yeah. No.
That
and
sounds
the thing is
parallel to your experience, isn't it?
Yeah, because I'm a binge eater as well, so it's even worse. It's just terrible. Just the worst.
And I when I was an academic, I had a student who had an eating disorder who came to me and hadn't told their parents. And I took it upon myself to, I suppose, look after her, have letters sent to university instead of home, and I used to go to the clinic with her instead of a family member, and I got into a stand-up row with the nurse that said, you know, you've got some depression with your eating disorder, so we're going to put you on mirtazapine. And I thought, you cheeky fuckers, you're doing that because you know it's going to make her eat.
Yeah.
And the impact that's going to have on, you know, the control, which eating disorders are often about, is huge. And I had to advocate for and say, I strongly urge you to not give this person mirtazapine because you know that's going to make them eat. And yes, you know, clearly there is a process of reintroducing food in a healthy way to prevent the health issues associated with some eating disorders, but you don't sneakily do it by giving someone a tablet which makes them more hungry.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds really underhand.
I was super pissed off.
So, James, you know you're on ADHD medication. Do you find that you get side effects now, or did you at the beginning and they've subsided?
Yeah, I did at the beginning. The biggest side effects I got at the beginning was anxiety. And it's a common side effect. And what I found was that it would last for the first few days of an increased dose. So when I first started taking 20 milligrams for the first 4 days, I would describe it as my threshold for anxiety was reduced. So I wasn't always anxious, but I could very quickly become anxious, and then it would settle and I'd go up to 30, and then I have 4 or 5 days of, again, a reduced threshold for anxiety. And then once I'd settled on kind of 60 and then 70 milligrams, the main side effects I get, I would say, are sleep, and for most people insomnia is an issue because lisdexamfetamine, for those that don't know, is a slow release form of amphetamine. So its half-life, which means that it's the amount of time it takes for the body to get rid of half of it, is 13 hours. So 13 hours after taking a 70 milligram tablet, you still got 35 milligrams in your system. And that means if you take it late enough in the day, if you try and go to sleep, you might struggle. Now, because of my many, many health conditions and prescription medications that I am clearly addicted to, one of them that I take is a benzodiazepine, a bit like Valium, it's Xanax or clonazepam, actually Clonopin. And just to let you know, the reason I take for that is because when I'm asleep, I spasm like I'm fucking a ghost, apparently. And that is obviously something which, when I first got together with Mrs. ADHD, was troubling for her because she thought, is he having sexy dreams because he's lying in bed thrusting from the hair? So I actually take clonazepam, which it isn't a sleeping tablet, but it does make you drowsy. And sometimes even with that, there are nights, and my sleep patterns are up and down, where I get into bed and just immediately know it's not going to happen, and get up and I'll get half an hour's sleep. That's the main side effect for me, is a disrupted sleep pattern. Obviously, I see the appetite suppression as a positive side effect, because as a binge eater, anything I can use to stop me from engaging in that activity, and if I really want to, then I will. If I'm in a bad place, it's my maladaptive coping mechanism, because it, yeah, all it does is delay the badness, because you get the guilt and the shame afterwards. But yeah, for me, those would be the two side effects, is the disrupted sleep and appetite suppression.
It's not too bad then.
And it varies from person to person. The most common side effects, obviously you can get changes in heart rate, and it has sped my heart up slightly, if you believe my Apple Watch, that my heart rate's got slightly higher, but I'm also grossly unfit, to be honest. And it can cause headaches. It can cause gastrointestinal issues, because interestingly, lisdexamfetamine doesn't just cause dopamine and noradrenaline, two neurotransmitters that methylphenidate increases to be increased. It also increases serotonin. Now, serotonin is kind of known as the mood neurotransmitter, but what most people don't know is 80% of serotonin in the body is actually in the gut. Your gut has a separate brain, and it's a completely separate nervous system which drives all the different processes in the gut, like squeezing the smooth muscle to force the food through. So if you take something that causes serotonin release, it can give you the squits. So kind of dodgy bowel habits, headaches, tachycardia, sleep issues, and appetite suppression are probably the most common side effects in general for that medication.
What medication was that again? Was that the
lisdexamfetamine? Yeah,
I'd say it's any insomnia. Anyway.
How they all affect people so differently. Like when I was on Elvance, I could literally take a tablet and I'd know when it was kicking in, because I'd just get so sleepy. Could quite comfortably sleep 4 hours a day.
Yeah, and that fascinates me. So anyone that listens to the podcast knows that I am shockingly open about all my behaviors. I've been a substance abuser for years, and the first time that I took Lisdex and cocaine at the same time, and so what happens to you, Shelley, is called paradoxical calming. For most people with ADHD get a bit of this. The paradoxical calming for us is that kind of the noise in the brain lessens a bit. That kind of internal motor that drives us, the incessant bees in the brain, when we take something that causes dopamine release, that quietens down a bit. In your case, it's a step further. It makes you sleepy. Mrs. ADHD is the same. When she takes Lisdex, she's yawning and she could have a nap. Now, I cannot sleep at all on it, but the first time that I took Lisdex whilst also partaking in cocaine, I got confused as to why I was getting tired taking cocaine. So of course the obvious answer is take more cocaine. So I was shoveling cocaine up my nose, trying to wake myself up, just making myself more and more sleepy, not knowing that actually too much dopamine can cause this kind of paradoxical calming effect of making you sleepy. So for some people, just having that little bit of what is a stimulant absolutely makes you tired, sleepy, yawny, have to have a nap in the day. And I suppose it's one of the key take-home messages of all of medicine. We are all different. And if you take a big population of people and look at how they respond to something, a diet, exercise, and medication, you will have kind of a line where you'll have hyper responders, people who really improve on it. The people in the middle who are generally responders, you'll have non-responders, doesn't do anything, and you'll have negative responders. So they'll get worse. And that's because we're all different. We're all physiologically different, genetically different. Our brains, our livers, all these organs work a little bit differently. And that's why there isn't ever kind of one medication that works for everybody in every situation for one particular disease, because we're all a little bit different.
So this is the reason why every time I have something like coffee, I can just fall asleep. Because most people, they say, oh, I can't have a coffee before bed, but I can literally drink a coffee before bed and I'm asleep.
Yeah, it doesn't impact me at all.
I've never got that. And again, it is probably because of there is a relationship between caffeine and dopamine, and for many people it is a stimulant. But I've never understood that kind of not a myth, but I suppose that meme of like the coffee jitters and, yeah, you know, I can't function till I've had a coffee, and I can't have a coffee after 7 o'clock because, yeah, it does fuck all to me. other than taste like Bigfoot's penis, it's horrible stuff. Why would you not drink tea instead, for God's sake?
Tea is lush. I do prefer
tea is lush. Coffee yeah. makes you shit yourself.
Yeah, especially wow, two of teas will make me shit myself. Five cups in a row.
You're always shitting yourself.
Oh, no. Welcome to the What Makes You Shit Yourself podcast.
We should do a little side episode.
Definitely.
You're going to be the main star, Shell.
No, I think I'll take a backseat on that one.
James.
Yes, go on.
I was going to ask you a question. So, you know, like, obviously you've taken a lot of meds, you know a lot about meds. If someone has anxiety alongside ADHD,
yeah,
what would you say? Like, obviously, I know you're not going to recommend the bed because everyone's different. But from your perspective, what works for you with your anxiety?
So the way in which a clinician would look at this is they would often treat the most pressing issue first. So if the anxiety was severe, they would want to treat the anxiety before the ADHD. Now, in many people, the anxiety is caused by undiagnosed ADHD. Most of us that have had anxiety as undiagnosed adults, that anxiety comes from probably biological differences in the brain, but also living as a neurodivergent person in a world where we're not valued, you know, masking, having to fit in, doing all these things at the cost of our mental health can cause anxiety. The fear of rejection, you know, the shame, emotional dysregulation, all of those things can drive anxiety. So actually, for a lot of people who have anxiety and ADHD at the time of diagnosis, it would probably be effective to treat the ADHD, but the general approach is treat the anxiety first and then treat the ADHD in terms of medication. Now, part of the problem with that is that the tools that we have for treating anxiety are very blunt. Again, you're talking nowadays antidepressants. So the anxiolytic medications like the benzodiazepines, they don't give them out because they're addictive. He says, having taken them for 15 years and being very addicted to them.
How do you carry on getting them?
because GPs are too busy to ask, and it was a consultant that prescribed it for periodic limb movement fucking ghost disorder, and therefore I can always point back and say, well, that consultant said I need this, and please don't take them off me. But they don't tend to give these out because of their addictive nature. So they will give you sertraline or citalopram antidepressants because they have been shown to cause a bigger reduction in anxiety than a placebo. But again, you know, we've said the side effects that they can have are vast. So yeah, normally it would be approaching the anxiety first and then the ADHD. But I think the research needs to be looked into to try and identify, well, actually, if you treat the ADHD, you know, indirectly, are you also treating the anxiety? Is the ADHD the foundation for that anxiety?
Yeah, a life of just never feeling like you're quite on the right
exactly. page. Exactly.
And yeah, I think as well, for me, does. Anxiety has been, when I look back, anxiety has been quite protective for me. Like, it's almost like whenever I've succeeded in anything at life, it's always been in spite of my ADHD because I was anxious about something else. It's almost like my body's coping.
It's a maladaptive coping process in some cases. So it depends often whether it is cause related anxiety or generalized anxiety. So I'll give you an example. I'm a fucking mess today, guys. And you know what? It's only because I have messed you around so much that I'm here, because I went for a scan at the hospital. And one of the glorious beauties of ADHD is what we call rapidly cycling moods. So this morning I was full of beans, went to the hospital, had to lie still for 35 minutes in a scanner, which when you've got ADHD is a little bit difficult. But afterwards, you know, I was fine, sunny day, drove home, massive anxiety for no reason. Absolutely no trigger. I didn't have anything on the horizon that I was worried about. I had one meeting all afternoon. I was just going to sit and watch Netflix, but just overwhelming anxiety. Now that's anxiety that is kind of, if you like, generalized anxiety. There isn't a trigger. I'm not anxious about having a deadline or anxious about doing stuff. But you're right, we often use anxiety as a maladaptive driver of engagement with tasks or engagement with people or engagement with activities, because it is a way of kind of keeping us or allowing us to get engaged, even though it's at the cost of our mental health. Now, for some people, that anxiety would stop them from being engaged. But obviously with ADHD, because of the low self-esteem, the people-pleasing, RSD, etc., that anxiety of letting people down, that anxiety of being thought less of, that anxiety of... So one of the... Sidebar. One of the things that I finally... It took me 48 years to do this. I finally accepted... And this sounds ridiculous, and you guys know this viscerally. I am an unreliable person. Now, me saying that doesn't sound powerful, but I've spent 48 years just not wanting to admit that, and trying to be reliable at the cost of my mental health. So if I'm in a bad place in the past, I would still go to a wedding or a meeting or go and see my family or do something social. At the cost of my mental health, I would sit there just with massive anxiety and social phobia and desperate to get home. And I finally owned the fact that I'm unreliable. And that means that actually, if I don't feel like I can do something, I'll just cancel. Even at the last minute, sorry, can't make that. I'm not in a good place. And the weight that's taken off my shoulder, the weight it's lifted by me accepting that I can say, yeah, I'm not going to do that. And yes, it lets people down, but I've managed to own that. And I think that's really powerful for people with ADHD to accept. And it's difficult with low self-esteem, which I have, but to accept that it's okay to say no. It's okay to let people down. It's okay to put yourself first if you don't want to put yourself into an unsafe situation. And anxiety is kind of at the core of that, because often it's those situations that drive anxiety more triggered as opposed to generalized fashion.
It's interesting you should say that, because I've got to that point now. So I call myself flaky. I say, oh, I'm just flaky. I'm just, because if I don't want to do something, if I do it, then my mental health just gets worse. And actually I end up worse, overthinking it, getting anxiety, thinking I can't be bothered with life anymore. And I just hate it. So now I have to say to myself, if I don't want to do something, I just need to be honest and own the fact that I am a flaky person. And I hear these people online talking about, oh, you know, you should be the type of person that when you say you're going to do something, you should do it because you're a liar. I'm like, I don't really care. And I actually like it when other people are flaky as well. So when today I said to Shell, I'm so nervous and anxious. I'm on edge. I don't know why. I've got so much anxiety. Talking. Honestly, James, fantastic that you're on here, and I couldn't wait for you to come on here. But if you'd said tonight, guys, I'm not going to be able to do it, I'd have been like, fine, perfect. I can just chill. I can watch TV, and then I don't have to be my anxious self. Does that make sense?
No, completely. And I, 5 minutes before this meeting, I was sat here going, it's okay, calm, breathe. Now I'm absolutely fine. Because obviously I'm enjoying myself. I'm talking to two fucking awesome people about stuff that interests me. But often, you know, anxiety is not rational.
Yeah.
Particularly when it's generalized anxiety that doesn't have a cause. You know, anxiety is something we don't control. And again, it comes down to forgiving yourself. Shell, I'm going to do some really quick coaching with you now. Okay.
Okay. Well, do you know what? I was going to ask you about coaching afterwards. So
It's a nice segue.
It's almost like we planned this.
Exactly. And as you know, nothing I ever do is planned, and it all goes to plan if it is planned. So when we look at that specific example there, where you kind of, your goal, you said you wish you would be more able to say no to things if you didn't feel safe, if you had anxiety about doing something or going somewhere, taking that power in that situation. Ask yourself two questions. What are the consequences of me not going? And in most circumstances, the consequences aren't massive. The consequences are, well, you know, that person might be a bit let down or that meeting will get rescheduled. And then ask yourself, what are the consequences of me going? And the consequences are often, it will affect my mental health. That mental health will affect my relationship. I will feel anxious. I will feel ill. And if you phrase the decision like that, and it's difficult for us to put ourselves first, but if you understand that the world still turns if you don't turn up to something or if you reschedule something, you know, that we it's not Armageddon. If you say, you know, I'm sorry, I can't come to that meal, or actually, can we reschedule for next week because I'm struggling a little bit? 99% of the time, people will just say, okay. And if people don't, that's on them, not on you. And part of this acceptance comes from understanding, normally through actually saying no and seeing in an evidence-based way that, oh, well, nothing bad happened. You know, I didn't lose a friend, or, you know, I didn't lose my job for missing a meeting. And when you realize that often nothing bad happens, that evidence can help you then accept that you have the power to say no.
It's definitely something I need to work on. I'm so bad for it. Like, I'll agree to something just because someone's asked me, and I don't want to let them down. Even in the back of my mind at the time, I'll be thinking like, why are you agreeing to this? You don't want to do this. And then the pre-build up, I'll be like, oh, I don't want to go. This is going to be awful. And then I'll probably fake a smile while I'm there, but not have a good time. And then I'll get home and Jamie, my husband, will be like, oh, how was it? And I'll be like, oh, it was really fucking shit. What a waste of my time. I didn't want to go. And he's always like, why didn't you just not go? But I can't do it.
And I get that. But what you can do is make progress. At every step of that process, you have the power to say no. So you have the power to say no when you're asked. You have the power to say no the day after you're asked. You have the power to say no a week before the event. You have the power to say no 5 minutes before you're going to do something. Because we're talking coaching about spheres of influence. There are three spheres. The things you can control, the things you can influence, and the things you can neither control nor influence. You can control whether you go to that thing, but you have to accept that you can control it. And that takes a little bit of acceptance of your importance. And obviously we often have low self-esteem and we're people pleasers and we put other people first, but you can redirect that to your partner or to your family or to your loved ones, and using the oxygen mask analogy, which is very common in coaching, which is, you know, when you're on the plane and they do the emergency announcement, what do they say about the oxygen masks? Put it on yourself first before you put it on others, because you can't help other people if you don't help yourself first. So even if you can't find the self-esteem or the self-love to say no, think about the people around you and think, if I do that and I'm going to be anxious and it's going to affect my mood, you know, for weeks before, and I'm not going to sleep because I'm going to be anxious. If the reward of helping yourself isn't enough, the reward of being there for the people that you love might be.
Yeah.
And it is a process. Coaching is always about what's the next step, taking stepping stones to get to where you want to be. But just by reframing things, accepting that you can say no, and you can use what's called the positive no, which is where you break it into three parts. And the first part of the positive no is acknowledge their request. So, yeah, I'd love to come on that podcast. The second part is, but I'm not gonna. And the third part is offer an alternative, which is, I could maybe do it in the future, though. And what you do then is you deliver a no, which doesn't insult the person that's asking, but asserts the fact that you're not going to do it. Because often we just don't want to say no, because we think, because of RSC, they'll think less of us. But if you frame it as a positive no, oh, your podcast's brilliant, I'd love to come on it. Unfortunately, I can't at the minute because, you know, I'm really compressed with my work and I haven't really got the time, but I'd love to come on in the future. You've just said no, but you said it in a way that makes them feel heard and makes them understand the importance of their request. So practicing the positive no as a way of taking control over situations can really help.
And that's what James did to us.
I did the sorry it was when no. And then the guys, my mental health's in the shit bin at the minute. Do you mind if we don't do it? And then the not answer WhatsApp for 4 months, no. So I did a variety of different no's with you guys, to be fair.
And yet, like herpes, we just kept coming back.
Exactly. Ironically, no, I won't say that.
You can say whatever. We don't get easily offended.
No. It was going to be aimed at Mrs. ADHD, actually. But yeah,
she's not here, and you're still abusing her.
Yeah, she's not in the room to defend herself. And obviously, she's got biceps bigger than the Incredible Hulk. So I have to watch what I say nowadays.
Yeah, you don't want to mess with her.
So with that shit coaching out of the way.
Yes.
No, in all seriousness, obviously you do coaching. You gave some really good advice there. How does coaching work, and how does it differ from, say, something like therapy, which people are more used to, I suppose?
It's a good question. There are levels of crossover. So if you look at the issues that most commonly people with ADHD come to a coach for, the top one's RSD. And for anybody listening that's considering coaching, coaching has to set you up for success, and that means having realistic expectations. And I can tell you now, if any coach ever says to you, oh, have six sessions with me and I'll cure your RSD, they're talking bullshit. RSD is the hardest thing to fix. In fact, you can't fix it. What you can do is learn to spot triggers for RSD better, learn to cope in the moment better, and learn to compress the period afterwards where you kind of hate yourself and hyper-focus on whether you've been rejected a little bit. And therefore, the emotional side of ADHD, which is often emotional dysregulation and RSD, it kind of skirts on therapy, because you can ask people to change their thought processes. You can ask people to change and reframe their thoughts. Most of ADHD coaching, though, is what we would call kind of the executive function stuff, the day-to-day stuff like procrastination, failure to launch, productivity, time management, a lot of relationship stuff. And coaching is, it's interesting because every coach is a bit different. Alex is different to me, for example. Alex has this psychopathic ability to be non-directive. So he can sit there and just say nothing until a client will just say something. I struggle a bit with wanting to help them find the answer. So coaching really should be about working in a partnership to help a client self-author or come up with themselves what their issues are, where they are with those issues now, why they're not where they want to be, what are the barriers to getting where they want to be, what are the options they've got available to them to get where they want to be, and then, you know, the practicalities, the accountability, when, what, where, why are they going to get there. And coaching really has to be about just one thing. So you focus on one thing at a time rather than, you know, let's do RSD and procrastination and time management, because that's not going to work. And it has to be about accepting that you're not going to fix things in two sessions. You know, it's about what's the next step, what's the next little step to get you towards success. And therefore, for example, it might be that, you know, somebody comes with three key issues and the biggest is procrastination. So you would have a session where you would call a deep dive, get everything out on the table, tell me what you procrastinate about, who with, how it makes you feel, you know, what the triggers are for procrastination, how you might have overcome it in the past. Get that all out on the table. And then in the next session, coaching is not a magic trick. You follow, there are loads of different really wanky acronyms. I use one called GROW, which is goal, reality, options, and what, where, when, why. And you ask questions. So you say, so what would success look like be? Where do you want to get to with your relationship with procrastination? And as long as you make that goal, and it's another wanky acronym, SMART, so specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, and time constrained. Because if you think of the goal of
SMART goals,
I loathe any kind of business acronyms, but if you think of the goal of tidying the house, it sounds like, yeah, that's okay, that's a reasonable goal. The house will never be tidy. Because it's a repeated cycle of tidying. Exactly. Now, a SMART goal would be maybe clean out that drawer, because it's specific. It's just that drawer. It's measurable. The drawer will be tidy after I've cleaned it. It's achievable because it's just a drawer. It's realistic. It's within your capability. And if you say I'll clean that drawer out by the end of today, it's time constrained. So that's really what coaching is. It's about identifying a path to success that is achievable, because it has to set you up for success and not failure. So if you set these big lofty goals, and I've got like 19 coaching clients at the minute, and I love coaching them. There are a couple who have started in the last couple of months, and you can kind of tell in the first session that it's not going to work because their aim is unachievable. You know, they don't want to have RSC, they don't want to have ADHD, you know, and therefore when you start to try and get them to identify what the small steps are, they don't want small steps, they want big steps. Yeah. They want, you know, they want in 4 weeks to not have RSD, and that it's just not going to happen. And if you look at what is probably the gold standard post-diagnostic pathway for somebody with ADHD, realistically it should be medication if wanted, coaching, therapy, and a structured psychoeducation course. And nobody gets that. Not one person in the UK gets that. There are no national psychoeducation courses. There are for diabetes. There's a course called Desmond you can go on, which teaches you about exercise and diet and medications that you're on. But there isn't for ADHD. Coaching is absolutely not provided for unless you get an individual funding request approved by your GP, and that doesn't happen very often. Therapy is difficult to get, and most of it isn't from an ADHD trained specialist. So you can get CBT, yeah, but if they don't really understand ADHD, it's probably not going to work. So what are you left with? Medication. And for 20% of people, that doesn't work. And for other people that are medication hesitant, they don't want to take it, you're left with, here's a diagnosis. There you go.
Good luck with
and that's
exactly.
Go into the world and understand things and you know, don't just unravel and hyperfocus and all the things you now know are ADHD and feel like things are getting worse. It's ridiculous because we know these things can help, but the resources and political will are not there to provide them.
So how did you get into coaching? Like, what was your first
step? It's balloonhead, wasn't it, obviously? Because I realized when just before I got diagnosed, and I'd known for years I probably had it, because Alex had told me 8 years before I got diagnosed. When he got diagnosed, he said, "You've totally got it. You're more ADHD than I am." We laughed, and I did nothing about it. So I'd been thinking about it for a while as my mental health declined. And I noticed actually that Alex had been surreptitiously coaching me for years. I'd not noticed it. He's a sneaky little fucker. And what he'd been doing is asking me questions. When I had an issue, like, I'm really struggling with this thing, he'd ask me questions. And I'd say, well, yeah, no, there's that. And then he'd ask me another question. And I didn't know that that's what coaching was. But I soon realized he's been practicing on me for ages. So it's interesting because a lot of people, because we talked about that, will contact the charity or the podcast saying, well, Alex is James's coach. I mean, he's not, but he did informally coach me for the first kind of few weeks pre-diagnosis and then post-diagnosis. And then very quickly, I thought, this is something I want to learn. So I did just some kind of an introduction to coaching course while I was still at university, did some follow-on courses for that. I'm now doing a follow-on course for that. And because coaching isn't a thing, there isn't a professional statutory regulatory body, anyone can be a coach, you know, I just got some flying hours in, started off doing it for free, and then when I got a bit of experience, started off doing it for almost no money, learning how to coach people with ADHD, because learning on the job is far better than kind of doing a course, particularly if you've got lived experience of ADHD. What I would say to anyone out there that's looking for a coach is there's lots of different coaches, and just like therapists, they range from amazing to dangerously bad, and most of them are in the middle, which is they're quite good, you know, effective. But there is a massive difference between a coach that has lived experience of ADHD and a coach that's done a course on ADHD. Because they will have learned about executive dysfunction, they will have learned about distraction, but they won't have lived it. And therefore, it is quite common, for example, that after, say, the second session, you'll have agreed on two activities or two tasks to work on. And of course, 2 weeks later, you'll have forgotten. And then you'll think, oh, shit, what was I meant to be doing? And then you might not do that, turn up to your session. And I've heard this reported several times, you know, coaches saying things like, well, this is your journey. You get out what you put in. If you're not going to do the work, then you're not going to get the benefits of this. Oh. And you just think, you don't understand ADHD at all if you're saying that. And I've spoken to so many kind of coaches, therapists and psychiatrists about this. And the broad message I've received back is that, yeah, a coach with lived experience of ADHD is often the best coach, because they understand where the client is coming from. They don't just have empathy. They have a shared experience.
I suppose you don't even need to have any sort of qualification, because if you've got ADHD, like you said, you know what it's like to struggle. You know what works for you, and therefore you can give your time and you can give your energy and what you've learned to other people if it works for you.
If you've got the fundamentals of coaching, so you can do a course of £15 on read.co.uk or Udemy that will teach you the basic model of coaching. It will teach you how to build rapport, how to structure a session, how to use any of the different models, and the GROW is the most popular model. Once you've got that nailed down, so you know how to build rapport, how to have a chemistry session, which is where you explain coaching and work out if you've got rapport, how to ask the right questions, once you've got those fundamentals of coaching, if you combine that with your lived experience and as much as you've learned about ADHD, you're probably going to be a good coach. And it's difficult at first to not talk too much. You know, Alex talks about how he's got a sign that says shut the fuck up above his laptop, and or STFU, because obviously he's far too polite to swear, because you have to try and let the person you're coaching talk more than you, which when you've got ADHD is obviously difficult because you want to interrupt and talk and you want to answer the question for them. So sometimes I find myself having to fight the urge to do that. But if you've got those fundamental skills, you know, personally, I think that's more effective than someone that spent £10,000 on an American accredited ADHD coaching course.
Oh, yeah, I've seen those.
But doesn't really understand ADHD at that kind of cellular, visceral, I have lived that level.
That's interesting. So I've had a couple of people ask me whether or not I would do coaching and if I would coach them, and I've never even had coaching, so I said no. But it's something that I'm thinking about. I think I'd probably like to have a little bit of coaching first and sort of get the vibes from that, and then maybe
if you want help with that, obviously I'll help you. But like I say, my advice would be, because the cost is low and the time commitment is low, is do one of these kind of 6 to 10 hour online courses that just teaches you the fundamentals. You know, what is coaching, why is it different to mentoring, what is a model of coaching, to teach you to use open-ended questions, to use active listening, to reiterate and to summarize. Once you've got that basic framework of skills, your understanding of ADHD and applying that framework, you know, again, it's not that difficult to make a start. And then it really is just about getting those flying hours in, is doing it. Normally you'd start by free with a friend and seeing how it goes, etc., and build from there. But if you want any help or advice, mate, you know I'll help you.
Yeah, Sparky's agreed to be my guinea pig, but yeah, that would be amazing. Thank you.
So anyway, Shell's made this all about her, as usual. James, can you give us one coping strategy that you use to manage ADHD? Now, I know, like, obviously, we listen to your podcast, we know a lot about you, and you, is it cyclothymia that you have?
Yeah, so cyclothymia is one of the 7 bipolar disorders, so it's often called mild bipolar in that you don't have fully manic episodes, and you tend to be like every month I'll have a low, and it is a very deep low, and then probably once a year I'll have a hypomanic episode. So the two are quite commonly seen together.
The reason that I'm asking about one coping strategy is because I know you struggle as well. What is it that helps you in your darkest moments to cope?
I'll give you an ADHD coping strategy and a cyclothymia coping strategy. The ADHD coping strategy is get a PA. I know that sounds ridiculous, but ADHD is effectively not having an internal PA. Now that doesn't have to be a person, but there is so much technology and software and things that can support our lack of executive function that utilize what you can afford. Now, I have an Apple Watch, but you don't have to get an Apple Watch. You can get a smartwatch for £30 that will give you all your notifications from your phone. And if you have a calendar that has all of your appointments on it and you set a reminder to be 15 minutes before when your watch vibrates, you're more likely to remember it. If you've got a smart speaker and you use that smart speaker and just say to it, I'm not going to say it because it's next to me, but you say, hello, thing that sounds a bit like... Wanexa, can you set a reminder for 3:30 for me to set off to the dentist? And then you'll have this, and if you set it up so it's in every room, then it's annoying, believe me, but you'll have this this big loud reminder, and then that will be a prompt which will make it more likely for you to engage. Nothing will work perfectly, nothing will work every time, but it's about trying to build a level of consistency. For cyclothymia, the biggest thing I learned was it's gonna pass. It will pass. And because the way in which a cyclothymic low tends to present, it's between 4 and 10 days of low mood. And if you look at my mood diary, it's almost like having premenstrual dysphoric disorder. It's like once a month you can see this kind of 7 to 10 days of red. I use the Bipolar UK's mood tracking system. And at first, and listen, my mental health is worse now than it was before my dad got ill back in October. But even now, when I'm in that low, I know it's going to pass, and I can tell myself that. And even when I'm having all the worst thoughts and, you know, I don't want to be here, I can still say it will pass. Mm-hmm. And that's the most important thing, because when you're talking about significant, you know, trigger warning, klaxon, suicidal ideation, and significant thoughts of, you know, your existence, for example, a permanent solution to a temporary problem can be tempting, but it's a temporary problem. So accepting that it will pass, for me, was the biggest thing. For some people, it's having a picture of a loved one in your wallet or your purse, so you can take that out and look at them and remember that there is something in your life that's wonderful, something that's good. But for me, it's genuinely getting to the point where I can accept, yes, I feel shit, but I know this is going to pass, and I've just got to ride it out.
I sometimes think if I suffer with something like that because of low mood, because there'll be times where I will say to Charlotte, I don't want to do the podcast anymore. I don't even want to turn up. I don't want to record. I'm really, really negative, and everything with ADHD just makes me feel even worse. And I just think, fuck ADHD. ADHD has made me like this. Like, what's the point? So that's really interesting to hear. And I know that it does pass. So I'm really sorry, Charlotte, that you have to deal with that sometimes. But, you know, you took me on. You got to deal with it.
I'm used to it now, because I know that I do it as well. Like, probably more than once a month, one of us will be like, should we just drop this in? Like, what's the point?
this is why we, for our podcast, this is why we made the move to monetizing it and separating it. Well, we separated from the charity because, Jesus, some of the stuff we say is going to bring a charity into disrepute, for fuck's sake. but equally, it got to the point in the last 6 months where all three of us had said, I'm not doing this anymore. I just can't. It's too much. Because when you've got a full-time job and you're running a charity and you're coaching people and you're trying to write, record, edit, publish and promote a podcast, and, you know, one out of the three of us would be like, oh yeah, I can't make it today, and then I'd feel massive animosity to that person. You'd be like, oh, for fuck's sake, I'm struggling too, but I can be there. And it would cause friction and arguments. And we all said at one point in the last 6 months before about June, I can't do it anymore, that's it. And then we realized the only way we could carry on is if we could create enough space by kind of buying out a little bit of time so that there was space for us to do that. And I get it. It's difficult because you're doing something that's important to you. But if you're not in the right headspace, particularly if you've got, like, this is a really friendly, it's a jolly, it's a funny chat. If you're not in a good place, you're not going to have that friendly, jolly chat. And we've cancelled podcasts 5 minutes in where I've said, sorry, guys, I can't do it. I just can't do it. And I, without even saying anything, I've just closed down the studio and walked out because it's inauthentic. I can't do the jokes. I can't be funny because I'm just not in a place where that feels authentic. And then sometimes before a podcast recording, Alex might message me, or I'll message him saying, I'm in a really bad place. I can't be jolly. So Alex would say jolly because he's a wanker. But we are generally very accepting. We'll just say, listen, that's fine, just sort yourself out, we'll do it another time. But it is a lot of pressure. And if you extend that to everything in life, if you extend that to your relationships with your family, I have so much shame that I don't go and see my family at the minute, because a combination of, you know, physical ailments like migraines and back pain, my mental health being in the wheelie bin, and being really busy, I struggle to get over there. And I don't know what you guys are like in terms of times of the day. I get up early because I don't sleep very well. By 2 o'clock, maybe 3, my brain has turned into blancmange. Mm-hmm. That means that at the time of the day, the time of day where actually I could do stuff, Sam and I could go for a lovely walk, we could go to the cinema, we could go shopping, we could do something, I just sit on the sofa and internally scream. And therefore kind of doing stuff like seeing family, seeing friends, I can't. And there's a lot of self-loathing involved in that, because what I tend to then do is spend my best hours working and coaching people and doing stuff for the charity, and the hours where I'm most useless doing nothing when I could be doing something for myself. But it's difficult to switch it around and kind of do stuff for yourself at 5:30 in the morning.
That happens to me as well. It gets to a certain point in the day, and I don't know if it's the light going or something, I don't know, I won't want to do certain things like go out and see friends, go and see my family, go for that walk. But then I'll spend time like just doing nothing, like just going on my phone or editing something that I don't really need to be doing. I could have been doing it 9 o'clock in the morning, but I'm not doing it. I'm doing it like at midnight. It's just ADHD sometimes, I swear.
It is. But this is where, and obviously I haven't cracked this because I self-loathe about it, but this is where understanding what ADHD is at its kind of biological core is important. The reason you can go on your phone and do the editing is your brain finds it rewarding, and motivation comes from reward. So if you do a task and your brain finds it rewarding, you will repeat that task because you're motivated to do it. The going out thing, even if you really want to, if it's not giving your brain reward, you will not have the motivation to do it. So it is, you know, brain says no. And for me, that it can be like a 60-second thing. At 4:59, if I say to Sam, she's going to have a walk, and she loves us going for walks, and she'll say, yeah, and then she forgets and does like work for the charity for half an hour, you know, a couple of minutes after me saying that, if she's not come downstairs, I know I am not leaving the house. If I'd have walked out at 4:59, I'd have been fine. But at 5 or 5:01, I know it's not going to happen. Absolutely no chance.
This is what I was saying to Shell when we were recording an episode before you came on. I said to her, she says to me that we're going to meet at 6 and she's not there at 6:01. I'm not doing the episode anymore.
Hang on. You keep saying this as if I am the only person that is late to record. I would say it's 30% me, 30% you, and 30% both of us.
Yeah, I mean, I've only got an N=1 on this, but I have to say Sparky was late for the recording today, to be fair. I mean, apparently technical issues in rabbit ears is what the reason was. I'm not convinced.
I was there. You know I was there. Anyway, James, we've been rambling on for well over an hour and nearly 40 minutes. Oh, my God. Usually at the end of our episodes, we talk about one thing that we've ADHD'd this week. So we're going to ask you, I know you've probably got loads, what's one thing that you've ADHD'd this week?
It's hard when someone puts you on the spot, isn't it?
Yeah, so, I mean... My existence would be a good one. I've worked out that ADHD is basically working out how to do the things you do wronger. That for me is what ADHD is. And what I did today, actually, so I went to hospital for this bone scan. It's a very important thing for me because chronic back pain drives my mental health, and this bone scan is hopefully the last scan before they do something. And I couldn't find the letter. And the letter had the address of the hospital. I kind of knew the hospital, but which department is it in? So I was searching through the filing cabinet and it's not in. I've got a specific NHS like thing in the filing cabinet, packed full of letters. It's not in there. It's not in what we call the imminent drawer where the passports and the important stuff is. And I'm searching around my office. And I'm like, oh, for fuck's sake. So I drive to the hospital and park and just kind of take a guess. And it was in my scanner. I'd scanned it in and I'd added it to the appointments on my phone. And I didn't realize this until after I'd had the bone scan. When I got back home, went to use a scanner, went, oh, it's there. Why have I scanned it? Looked at the appointment. Oh, because actually I quite cleverly scanned it in and added it to the appointment.
So you had all the information you needed.
Yeah, all the information with all the time. But I'd forgotten that I'd done this and that I'd left the letter on the scanner.
I definitely recognise myself in that. I've definitely done similar before.
It's just, and the good thing is, like, again, for most of these things now, I can laugh and kind of say, "Ah, oh, you dickhead," rather than the self-loathing and the stuff that I used to do, which would just be, "Ah, why are you so useless?" And that emotional acceptance, blah blah blah, is such a big thing. You know, being able to de-weaponize the things that we do every day, so that, you know, most of the time you either laugh or shrug or say, "Well, ADHD
now you're like rock. Podcast content."
I mean, particularly now we're doing the extra. I mean, now we're doing the extra stuff, which, I mean, Christ, Sam's videos.
Yeah, the ADHD towers.
Yeah, it's long. I swear to God, it's longer than Lord of the Rings because Sam records 30 minutes a day. The first episode was 30 minutes long. Now she records 30 minutes a day and tries to edit it down, whereas I do like 2.5 minutes. here's something that happened in 30 seconds, whereas Sam's is this rambling monologue of 20 minutes. But because people genuinely Sam resonates with people. I think a lot of people feel less weird when they see Sam and feel seen and understood, and therefore they like it. I couldn't watch it, obviously, and I have to edit it. But absolutely. I've forgotten the question or the point, but it's been fun.
Yeah, I just hope that there's more IKEA furniture in the mix, because that's absolutely hilarious.
that word in this house. And we are going to have to go back there, but Jesus Christ on a bike. That was a stressful Sunday.
IKEA is stressful. IKEA is not ADHD friendly.
No, it's not. But
spoke about that before, haven't we?
And especially when the fucking instruction manual's in the wrong order. So it's page 1, then page 9, 10, and then 2, 3, and then 7, 8, 4, 5, 11, 12. So not only am I hamstrung by the fact that I can't follow instructions, but when they're in the wrong order... You know, it's almost like there's this one person at IKEA that's gone, hey, here he comes, let's mess it up for him.
Ruin his day.
Exactly.
Well, thanks so much, James,
thank you so
for
much
coming
for coming
on
and talking to us. We really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure, guys, and apologies that it's taken like 150 years to get me on here because you know, ADHD, I suppose.
Because ADHD. I mean, yeah. I think every single person we've had on the podcast, there's been some sort of problem from either their end or our end or both.
Most important thing is it's an accepting environment. We all know what we're like, aren't we?
And
I think that's the key, is that if somebody does say, oh God, yeah, sorry, I remember Sam did, I think at first getting the wrong dating or something, or I think when Sam came on, something like that happened with you guys, and it happens. We almost expect it to happen. In fact, if it goes ahead at the first scheduled date on time, that's a rare occurrence. That's rocking or shit, that is, isn't it?
Yeah,
definitely. Yeah, Sparky's still lording the Sam situation over me. Both me and Sam forgot and didn't turn up, and he didn't.
Amazing. Yeah, and I was just gonna say, you've ruined my perfect record by me being late today, but actually I was here on time, and then I remembered actually we had a guest on and we both didn't turn up shell, so we can't talk about anything.
That's really bad.
Anyway, guys, thank you so much for listening to us ramble this week, and we will see you next week for another episode of All Things ADHD.
Bye.
All right, that's everything this week, guys, but if you want to carry on with the conversation, join us over on our social media platforms. We're on all the major channels and our handle is @adopaminekick.
We'd also be super grateful if you could leave us a review on the podcast wherever you're listening, as it helps us to grow our audience and help more people. Okay, we'll see you in the next one. Bye-bye.
Bye.